From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It was almost exactly 2 years ago that two North Carolina representatives, both Democrats, filed a bill in the House that would legalize physician-assisted suicide in the state. The three other sponsors on the bill, also Democrats. The proposed legislation passed its first reading in the House and went to the Judiciary Committee, where it never emerged because, bill supporters say, it was too close to the crossover date in the legislature. That day is the last for a bill to pass out of the chamber in which it was introduced and move into the other chamber, in this case, the Senate, for consideration. There's hope, as we'll hear today, among Death with Dignity supporters, that the legislation will be introduced again this session. There is not a lot of time left. This session's crossover date, April 27th. But on this edition of Coastline, we're also going to hear from those who oppose these ideas, who say it not only raises the obvious questions about the sanctity of human life, but it sets up a dangerous and slippery slope for the deadly expression of implicit bias. Joining us today from Duke University is Professor Jennifer Hawkins. She's an associate research professor in the Department of Philosophy at Duke, and she's a faculty affiliate at the Trent Center for Bioethics, Humanities, and the History of Medicine at Duke School of Medicine. Professor Hawkins, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Also with us today is Carol Clay Sutton. She's the North Carolina State Coordinator for Not Dead Yet, a national grassroots disability rights group that opposes legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia. Carol Clay Sutton, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
And also joining us now is Edmund Tyriakian, the co-founder and executive director of Dying Right NC, a nonprofit that advocates for death with dignity legislation in North Carolina based on the model of the current laws in Oregon and California. Edmund Tyriakian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you for sponsoring this show.
And we would like you to be a part of this conversation. If you have a question for any of our guests today, or if you think about how your end will come and whether you want the option of physician-assisted suicide, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Edmund Tyriakian, tell us first about the legislation that you're hoping Democratic Representative Pricey Harrison of Guilford County will reintroduce this session. Under what circumstances, if this law passed in North Carolina, would a person be able to get a doctor to help them die?
Rachel, the law that we're looking for is very, very prescriptive, and it's full of safeguards that prevent any type of abuse that people have sometimes alluded to. The exact law that we're looking for requires an individual who has been diagnosed of suffering from a terminal illness likely to result in death within 6 months or less to issue two verbal requests to a doctor, followed by a written request to the same doctor. That doctor has to make a determination that the individual is indeed suffering from a terminal illness likely to result in death within 6 months, that individual is not, his mental judgment is not impaired by a depression or by some lack of reasoning. He has to refer the individual to a second doctor who has to, again, confirm that the individual is suffering from a terminal illness likely to result in death within 6 months and is not suffering from any type of mental disability or is not being coerced. There is an independent determination that the individual is not being coerced. Finally, the written request by the individual has to be signed by two independent, non-biased witnesses that cannot be heirs, family members, or someone interested in the outcome of the person. The individual, the doctor will write a prescription, and this is where many people are confused. The doctor cannot administer the medicine. The individual has to take it himself, and there's no obligation for the individual to take it. And in fact, the Oregon records, 20 years of data, show that in one-third of the instances, the individual never takes the medicine. He just uses it as something to give him comfort, to give him a sense of autonomy.
And I'm going to ask you about some of the history of not just this law, but how society has viewed suicide over the years. But first, Carol Clay Sutton, it is in the mission of Not Dead Yet
that physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are forms of discrimination. How can that be if this is something that is chosen by a person for themselves?
Well, there is no safeguard that proves that this is chosen for themselves first. The idea that taking it by yourself is the outcome is not necessarily borne out by the organ experience. It turns out that people are having this ingested into G-tubes, into tubes that are put into their stomachs. So you can take a large bore needle and insert it and press the plunger, and the person is gone. There is no requirement that a physician or someone else unbiased be there to witness the actual ingestion of the drugs.
So you're saying, on one hand, that this is a way that someone could actually be murdered.
Absolutely.
In effect.
Absolutely. Tom Yauch was.
Who is Tom?
Tom Yauch was the last death by Jack Kevorkian. And his last word was wait. We saw that on tape during the court proceedings that convicted Jack Kevorkian of second-degree murder.
Professor Jennifer Hawkins of Duke University,
yes.
Is there research to support the allegation that, because as we'll find out as we go along, part of Carol Clay Sutton's concern is that implicit bias gets played out in some of these decisions, not intentionally. I mean, murder is one extreme, but there right. also, it can be a slippery slope. So is there research that supports the idea that, say, older people or people with disabilities or ill people are discriminated against by medical staff?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's very hard to get research relating to this in terms of physician-assisted suicide. So even though there are states where it's legal, you know, the data we have is primarily about who requested it, things like that. It's very hard to know what goes into the decision-making. There is different levels of data about attitudes people have towards people with disabilities and towards the elderly. And there's a lot of data that shows that able-bodied people make assumptions about the quality of life of people who are disabled or who are elderly that are quite different from the testimony of those people about their own lives. So if you ask a bunch of able-bodied people, how good would your life be if you became disabled or if you were sick or if you were elderly and frail, you know, they'll give you an answer that says they'll say, oh, it would be quite bad. I wouldn't want to live like that. Or maybe they won't say that, but they'll just say it'd be quite bad, much worse than it is now. But when you actually do studies of people with disabilities, they report finding their lives quite fulfilling. So there's obviously a discrepancy between the way people with various health conditions view their lives and people who are healthy think their lives would be like if they were in that situation. And that's cause for concern.
And Carol Clay Sutton, how would that play out then in medical decisions? What's your concern about that?
Well, for example, when my husband was ill with a stomach issue 5 years before he passed away, the physician actually put a DNR on his record without talking to us, without even discussing the issue with us.
Do not resuscitate.
That's correct.
Which means what?
It means that if he had a heart attack or something and stopped breathing, they would not do the cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
You're saying the medical staff did this without your knowledge, and you were his wife.
That's
correct. You were this person's wife.
Yes, that's correct. They put it on there with no knowledge, no consent, and the only reason we found out about it was he went to have a GI, an esophageal GI, and the anesthesiologist said that they would suspend the DNR during the procedure. And I said, what DNR? What are you talking about? He assumed we knew. He assumed we had consented to that.
And your conclusion from that is that they had looked at your husband, determined that he was so ill and elderly that
saving
him. He used
a wheelchair as well.
And he was in a wheelchair. Edmund Teriyakian.
Yes, I think there's a misunderstanding about the law we're talking about, because the law we're talking about addresses exactly the concern that Carol has just alluded to. We are trying to take away from doctors the power to euthanize patients with this law. That is exactly what this law does. It says the final determination is in the patient's hands, not in the doctor's. If the doctor, under any of the laws that we have in America, were to administer the lethal dose, either by ingestion or by injection, the doctor in Oregon, in Washington, and California would be guilty of murder or homicide. And that would be the case if the legislation passes here. This law has nothing to do with a disabled person. A disabled person is not eligible under this law, nor is an elderly person. The only people who can invoke this law is someone who has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. Whether you're disabled in a wheelchair or not, if you're disabled and you go to a doctor and say, I want to end my life, the doctor will say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. This law does not help you. Now, the doctor, and this does happen, what Carol's alluded to is very alarming. There is a way for doctors, in fact, to euthanize patients. It's called terminal sedation. It happens all the time. A doctor sees a patient in extremis who is perhaps suffering so greatly and in such constant pain because of a cancer that might have metastasized. The doctor begins sedating the patient to such an extent that eventually the person dies, or the person is withdrawn from hydration and nutrition and eventually dies. And that is a common practice in hospitals. It's a way for doctors effectively to euthanize patients. It would not happen with this law.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring physician-assisted suicide today with an opponent, an advocate, and a researcher from Duke University's School of Medicine. If you have a question for our guests, if you know someone who would like the option, or if you fear it would allow subtle biases to put more value on some human lives over others, give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. At some point in the not-too-distant future, every single one of us will be either a rotting corpse, ashes, or in some cryogenic chamber awaiting a medical miracle. And just as people are permitted to choose what happens with their remains and their possessions, should they be able to choose what happens with their bodies before they die? Should a person be able to get a prescription to end their own life? Or does it set up a dangerous slippery slope for discrimination? With us for today's discussion, Professor Jennifer Hawkins of Duke University, Carol Clay Sutton of Not Dead Yet, and Edmund Tyriakian of Dying Right NC. They're taking your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Monty from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hope everybody's doing okay. I completely support the law and the death with dignity. And in fact, I would even go a step further. And my wife works for hospice. I hear of horror stories. And I think that someone of sound mind should be able to make their decision just like a will, and say once I get to this certain point of not doing something, I think that it would, please put me to sleep. I mean, we do it with our loved pets. I think that's the humane thing to do. At least this law is a step in that direction. And
okay.
And if you, and not even on an emotional decision, financially, it also cripples. I mean, it just sucks the family's wealth. It sucks the state's wealth.
You're talking about when someone
is just lingering there and not coherent and suffering, until they die, being fed intravenously. And there's so many points that it hits on. And if it was set up like a will, there wouldn't be any family discussion of, hey, you know, you killed such and such, you know, you killed mom or whatever. She stated that in the will. I mean, that's how I feel about it.
Okay. Monty, thank you so much for your call. We had a little debate during the break about murdered people versus what actually happened under the law. And Edmund Teriakian of Dying Right NC, your point is when there are allegations of euthanasia happening, that is not in accordance with the legislation that you're proposing. Is that right? This is something that the patient has to do themselves.
The law would not protect any doctor that administered the medicine that he's prescribing. The only person that can take the medicine is the individual himself. And that is very important because we have to get the language terminology correct. The law that we're talking about does not anticipate or allow euthanasia. There were concerns expressed in 1997 when the Oregon law was first proposed that this would be a slippery slope leading to inevitably euthanasia. Absolutely not. We have had 20 years of very detailed data from the Oregon Department of Health that shows that all of the parade of horrors that the opponents came out with in 1997, every single one has not come true.
Well, Professor Jennifer Hawkins, yes, of Duke University, didn't you say earlier that it's difficult to parse that data for some of these misuses and abuses that are alleged?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you want to ask. I mean, I think we have good data that, and I'm not the best expert on the Oregon and data, but I don't think certain kinds of abuse do not seem to be present. What's more worrisome for people who, and I'm sure Carol will want to emphasize this, but what people worry about more, I think, is subtle influences on people, the ways in which assumptions people have about what death will be like, what kinds of conditions are worth living through or not, can subtly shape people's thinking and lead people to feel either can lead people to make decisions that they might not otherwise make and that perhaps aren't the best. I doubt seriously that so there's not much concern about, at least with this law, about coercion or murder. If there's worry about this law, I think it's just that people will select it voluntarily, but without proper thought or without the right reasons, and perhaps somewhat influenced by the views of those around them who assume that their illness or their prognosis is worse than it is. Or I understand that the law requires that you be very close to death. But many people who select this kind of medication to end their life are making assumptions about what kind of suffering they're going to encounter or what kind of Ed is exactly right that it's not a law that allows people who are not terminally ill but who are unhappy with some other condition to end their lives. It does. That's not how it works. So, but there can be people who have multiple things. So you could have someone who's both disabled and has a terminal illness, or who is feeble, or, you know, encountering various things connected with their terminal illness, who may feel pressure to end their lives. Now, I don't think that will be a huge number of cases. You have to find the right balance between giving people the opportunity to choose something they might value and worrying about why people will choose what they choose.
And Carol, you actually have an anecdotal story, Professor Hawkins, but I want to give Carol Clay Sutton a chance to respond first.
Yes. Actually, what we've found is that the DHS reports from Oregon cite disability as perhaps the top three reasons that people choose assisted suicide. Their feeling of being a burden on others, feeling of not having the ability to engage in activities, and so forth. Those are some of the top reasons for choosing assisted suicide in Oregon. But also, what's interesting and what we found in terms of researching this is that the investigation rate goes down of these kinds of issues. And you know, if a non-terminally ill disabled person happens to die under these circumstances, no one investigates. Kevorkian was a good example. When Janet Adkins, his first public victim, died, there were reams of investigations. When Tom Yauch died, there was half a page until it got on CBS, on 60 Minutes.
And
So there's that whole thing. But what we're most worried about, really, is what it does to the medical system. We have a medical system that's basically broken. We don't think that the medical system serves disabled people very well now. Accepting the idea that you might be better off dead than having this disability, you might be better off dead than having that.
And I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, because it does sound to me, I understand there's the issue of perhaps unconscious, implicit bias by medical professionals in some cases towards people who have disabilities. But that is a very different thing, is it not, from someone who has been diagnosed by a medical professional with a terminal illness and has 6 months left to live to the best of that medical professional's knowledge?
Well, physicians are very, very bad at determining that, Rachel. I was supposed to be dead three different times in my life. My parents were told I wouldn't live through the night when I was 5 weeks old. And as you can see from my gray hair, I'm significantly older than that.
Edmund Teriakian.
Just let me correct a couple of misrepresentations that Carol's made. I have the data from the Department of Health in Oregon. There are no records of disabled people who have used this law in Oregon. There's no records of it, because anyone who has applied for it has been diagnosed as having a terminal illness. Carol refers to some type of report that people are disabled who use it. That's not correct. The people that have used it have said that the principal reason they are invoking this law is because they're less able to engage in activities that make life enjoyable. The second thing is, Carol keeps on referring to Jack Kevorkian. Jack Kevorkian was prosecuted because he administered the medicine. That is what led to a homicide prosecution. This law does not allow that. The individual has to take it. Finally, are doctors bad at prescribing or predicting death, the lifespan of an individual? They're not perfect, but let's look at this. Hospice has been around since 1976 or so. To be admitted to hospice, you also have to be diagnosed as having less than 6 months to live. 83% of patients admitted to hospice do die within 6 months. Doctors can make a reasonable medical prediction. But this law goes even further. It requires two doctors to make that prescription. There is nothing in the law that forces the individual to take the medicine. It's the individual's final choice. And as I mentioned, one-third of patients never take the medicine. They use it as something that gives them solace, a sense of, I can control my life at the very end, when this cancer is destroying me, when I've lost all autonomy and sense of independence, this medicine lets me sleep at night.
You said that it's a couple of different physicians, medical doctors, who make the determination as to whether a person is suffering from some kind of mental illness or serious depression. Professor Hawkins of Duke University, you have a story, and this is not about assisted suicide, but there are implications here for this issue, about a woman who was hospitalized, went through a procedure.
Yeah. So I tell this story to illustrate the ways in which assumptions that people are making, medical team might be making, can influence what they do. So a friend of mine wrote this case. It's published. It's in the first chapter of a book called From Detached Concern to Empathy. And the whole book is about the emotional ways, the ways in which physician emotions shape their judgment. But this one is relevant to disability. So a woman came in for, with diabetes, came in for a second above-the-knee leg amputation. She'd been planning it for a long time. She knew it was coming. She was dependent on dialysis. However, she, although disabled, she valued her life, or at least did when she entered the hospital. She was an artist. She was a painter. She was able to paint. She had friends and community who helped her get around. She had quite a vibrant life in many ways. this only emerged in the course of this. So she came out of her surgery and the next day refused dialysis. And someone called a psychiatric consult to find out why the patient was refusing, because without dialysis she would die. And various people tried to talk to her. She wouldn't really say much about what was going on. Then finally, to one person, the author of this piece, she revealed that shortly after her surgery, when she was still in recovery, her husband had come to her and had chosen that moment to tell her that he had moved in with someone else, that he was divorcing her, and he'd said some quite nasty things about her appearance as a woman with a double amputee. And this had just crushed her, and she didn't want to think about anything, and she just wanted to, as she put it, go to sleep and never wake up. Now, what was interesting was that until this emerged, most of this team had just been assuming that she had decided that her diabetes was and being an amputee was so bad that she just had changed her mind and decided she didn't want to live. And they were pretty much just happy to go along with this. And in fact, one psychiatrist had said to the woman who eventually got the full story, "You're getting too emotionally involved in this. Can't you see she's just making the reasonable choice? It's an objective fact that she has nothing to live for." So whether people were willing to push for the real story in this case had to do with a lot with their assumptions about disability.
And so part
discovered,
of, go ahead.
Oh, no, I can stop. Yeah. I mean, I think.
Well, so part of your point with this story is that if there had not already been bias among the medical staff surrounding her about the quality of her life, they would have dug deeper initially when she refused treatment.
Exactly. If an otherwise healthy person suddenly, you know, or a non-disabled person suddenly refuses treatment, they'll spend a lot of time asking the patient, what's going on? Are you okay? Has something happened? Why are you choosing this? And of course, at the end of the day, if the patient is competent and they're refusing, they're allowed to do that. But people will try to make sure that that's really the case. They will make sure the patient is competent. They'll try to make sure that they know what they're choosing. But when you look at someone and you assume they're making a reasonable choice, you tend not to even ask those questions.
Edmund Teriyakian.
Well, let's keep in mind that the law we're talking about would not, this woman could not even invoke the law. She was not terminal in any way. It's a tragic case, but she was not suffering from a terminal illness. So this law would not apply.
Well, in this law, so you have these two medical doctors making an assessment and saying this person has no mental illness. How are doctors who are treating some sort of physical ailment qualified to evaluate a person's psychiatric health in the first place? That's just as a layperson, that's hard for me to get my mind around.
I think you have to realize the sequence of events. There's two oral written verbal requests separated by 15 days. This is a thought out process. This is not somebody who's just broken up with their girlfriend and is feeling terrible about life and decides on the spur of the moment to die. This is a person who has good cause to be worried about the next few months, because the next few months will be painful, will be suffering, and they're going to be terminal. There's no hope. There's no medical miracle out there. So already the person is clearly rational in explaining what he wants. If the doctor has any reason to believe that the person is suffering from a depression or some mental impairment, the patient will be referred to a professional mental health specialist.
It just seems like whether the patient is suffering from some sort of depression or other mental impairment, unless it's extreme and the patient is combative or it's some sort of, you know, very serious mental illness, how could a doctor, a physician of this sort, detect that? Jennifer Hawkins, is my skepticism unwarranted there?
Well, I think perhaps this isn't what you want. I do have some worries about it, but I think let me put something out here on the other side. I do think that my sense is that if this law passes, there will be some people for whom it's a great boon, right? There will be people who will have an ability to take control in a situation where they would not otherwise have had control. Most policies have their upsides and their downsides. And while there might be some worries, and they are real, about our ability to accurately recognize depression And I think we should definitely be worried about that. I think the hard question is, would this law do more good or would it do more harm? And I think you can clearly tell that there'd be some of each. And the question is, you know, how big? I'm going to say something a little bit different, because so far we've talked about the law which Ed has laid out, which is designed, as he said, and he's absolutely correct, it's designed to be as safe as you can make the law. And I tend to have less worries about that law, but I have a lot of worries about the future. And here's what I mean. Someone once coined the phrase, they said there are different kinds of slippery slopes, and one kind is a legal slippery slope. If you pass a law for something, and the law, you know, something that was previously not allowed becomes allowed, and if it's widely understood among people that the rationale for the law is a certain kind, so you say the reason we're doing this is to give people choice, to give people control, because people should be in charge of their lives. The problem is that even if the law you pass is very circumscribed, over time there will be people who will challenge you to push on that law, because they'll say, well, if the point of the law is to give me control, then why shouldn't I have control in these other cases? And so you have the worry that it'll be the first step in a series of moves, that people will revise the law later to make it more inclusive. And here's the things I worry about. One is the law, he says, is that requires that the patient take the medication. But there are people who can't take medication who are terminally ill and suffering, and some of them will say, hey, why can't I make use of this?
Right.
And some things like that.
And Professor Hawkins, that music means we're about to go to break, so I'll let you finish that point when you come back. You're
okay.
Listening to Coastline. When we come back from this break, we'll take a couple of calls about physician-assisted suicide. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we'll also go a little deeper into the quality of life questions. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Death, of course, is coming to all of us. Whether we have control over when and how it comes is the question today in the event of a terminal illness, when a person comes to believe that whatever time is left would only be torture. With us for today's discussion, Edmund Tyriakian of Dying Right NC, an advocacy group seeking to legalize physician-assisted suicide in North Carolina. Carol Clay Sutton of Not Dead Yet, a group that argues such a move would translate into a deadly form of discrimination against people who are older or disabled or ill. We also have Duke Professor Jennifer Hawkins of the Department of Philosophy joining us today. She is a faculty affiliate at the Trent Center for Bioethics, Humanities, and the History of Medicine at Duke School of Medicine. You can reach us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or coastline@whqr.org. In just a moment, we're going to talk to Ruth from Wilmington. But first, Professor Hawkins, I promised I'd let you finish your point.
Oh, well, before the break, I was just saying that one worry is about what would happen if you make this legal, but another worry is about whether making it legal would be the first step in a process in which the law keeps being updated, changed, and made more expansive. So I understand that's not Ed's intention. The law that's on the book, you know, on the table at the moment is very clear and very limited. But there will inevitably be challenges to that law. One case is that currently the law requires that, or would require, that the patient be able to take the medication him or herself. It's not allowing physicians to give medication. But there are patients who are terminally ill, who suffer greatly, and who cannot take medication. This was at the core of a challenge some years ago in Canada, back before they changed their laws. They now have a very permissive law. But at the time, Sue Rodriguez had Lou Gehrig's disease. She was diagnosed with that, which is a paralyzing illness. It's progressive and it's terminal. And Sue wanted to be able to control the time of her death. She wanted to live as long as she was able to interact with her family, but at a certain point, she wanted someone to be able to give her a lethal injection. Now, the law we're contemplating at the moment wouldn't allow that, but people will come back and say, well, isn't it unfair if you say that people should have control, then why is it that we give people who have the ability to end their lives control, but we won't let someone like Sue get help? And so then you have a pushback against one limitation. There are other limitations. Currently, the law as envisioned would only allow people who currently have mental capacity under the law to make their own decisions to choose it. But in other parts of American law, we allow people to write advance directives that would become operative later when they're incompetent. We allow them to refuse life-sustaining treatment through such directives. Someone sooner or later will challenge and say, why then don't we allow people to write advance directives saying that if I become terminally ill but I'm incompetent, someone can, I can get physician-aided dying. So I think it will be hard to hold the line at the law as it's envisioned.
It's an exploration of physician-assisted suicide on today's Coastline. And with us to answer your questions on this Wednesday, you just heard Jennifer Hawkins. She's associate research professor in the Department of Philosophy at Duke University, also a faculty affiliate at the Trent Center for Bioethics at Duke School of Medicine. Carol Clay Sutton is here. She's the North Carolina coordinator for Not Dead Yet, a group that opposes physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And Edmund Teriakian, he is the co-founder and executive director of Dying Right NC, an advocacy group that wants to see legalization in North Carolina of physician-assisted suicide. You can reach us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Ruth from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Great. I'm hands-free, so I'm not sure sometimes if my vehicle works correctly. So my background is in critical care, but I have worked in hospice as well over the last 25 years. And my experience with death and dying is quite vast. And I would let you know that I have never had the experience where giving pain medication at any level was to aid in death, nor have I ever worked with a doctor who gave or prescribed pain medication to aid in someone's death. Physicians' role is to prevent suffering, and that is the role as a nurse as well.
You've never witnessed abuse of, I guess, what would be palliative care.
Palliative care is not abuse.
Right.
Palliative care is a beautiful thing, as with hospice. It's the most important thing. What's most important is education in those areas to let people know that palliative care and hospice that has nothing to do with digging somebody's grave for them at all. It's about allowing somebody to make choices about how they want to live and die with dignity when it's their time to take their last breath when they want to. And I can tell you that it's very disheartening for some doctors to have to butt up against, and I'm not sure which woman that was who sounds a bit sensationalist. But it's kind of sad, but it's very hard for some doctors to see that when that's what they're up against is people that sound very ill-informed.
You're saying it's an unfounded allegation. Ruth, thank you so much for that call. We have Yvonne from Southport. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for bringing this topic to public awareness. I have been concerned about it for years. I have watched both my father and my husband exist miserably for years after having strokes. And they have each said to me, I wish you could shoot me. if I were a dog, you would put me down. Mm-hmm. And I told them, of course, I was sorry I couldn't do it. But I will say that if I ever get a really nasty diagnosis, I'm moving to Oregon, much as I love living in Southport.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your call, Yvonne. Carol Clay Sutton, and then I'll let you respond, Ed. Go ahead.
Yvonne, I am so sorry that you went through that. But it's so amazing that people on the outside assume that the person is having a much worse quality of life than the person actually is, for one thing. But the other thing is, when I was going through this with my husband, he also said, please shoot me. And once, you know, several times, actually. And the first couple times, I kind of laughed it off and said, well, the sheriff wouldn't like that very much. But finally, we sat down and we really talked about it. And what he wanted to know was, would I stay with him? Would I love him through it? That's what he wanted. He didn't want to be shot.
So you're saying he was concerned about the burden that he was putting on you, in a sense, and his desire for death was entirely related to what he was doing to you.
Absolutely. And too often that's the case, that people express a desire to die, but not because they really, really want to die right now, but because they feel like they're being a burden. And telling people, yes, you're being a burden, and taking them to die is the worst thing you can do.
Putting the law aside for a moment, and this is for you, Carol Clay Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine a circumstance in which someone would be suffering so much with a terminal illness that every moment of consciousness is torture?
I can imagine it, but with my husband, we had hospice, and it was beautiful. They relieved his suffering. His pain was well controlled right up to the very morning when he died.
Jennifer Hawkins of Duke University, is palliative care, really good palliative care, the answer to this instead of physician-assisted suicide?
People sometimes say that, and I'm very skeptical, in the sense that I don't doubt that good palliative care is a very good thing, and we need more of it, and not just for people who are terminally ill, but people who are suffering from chronic illnesses that leave them with great pain. But I think people differ dramatically in how they respond to life and death and illness. And some people, you know, palliative care can help control pain, but not everything, not all forms of suffering are about bodily pain. Some individuals will experience, upset about the experience of illness, primarily because of the effect they think it's having on others, but others just will experience it as bad for themselves. The problem is that there's no single truth that applies to all people, right? There are people who, for whom it's not the right option, and there are people who would find it very hard not to suffer at the end of their life, and palliative care can only do so much for them. Suffering is as much about your feelings and the meanings you give to the events in your life and the way you're looking at your situation as it is what your body is experiencing. And people come to death from as many different perspectives as there are ways of living.
Edmund Tyriakian.
You know, I'm very happy that Carol had that discussion with her husband, and that was probably the right outcome for them as a couple. But not everybody feels that way, and everybody should have as many choices at the end of life as possible. We firmly believe that hospice is an option, palliative care is an option, but this law would also be another option. Some people believe that suffering is good. Others don't want suffering. All this law does is it adds one more option for people to take control of their lives. And let's keep in mind one thing, Rachel. People will find a way of ending their lives if their suffering is too much. Let me give you a story. A doctor friend of mine in Chapel Hill told me this story. She was approached by a patient who was suffering from cancer. The patient said, please write me a lethal prescription. The doctor said, I cannot. I will lose my license. I could be arrested. The patient went out eventually, shot herself in the head in a forest in Chapel Hill. This doctor feels horrible. for the family that had to recuperate the body, it's horrible. But if you don't allow people to have a peaceful, dignified end, they will take measures in their own hands, and it can be far, far worse outcome for everybody involved.
And this gets right at the heart of, and Professor Hawkins, you have alluded to this as well, the quality of life questions and what Carol Clay Sutton said about how her husband was feeling. I mean, isn't all of one's life experience how one interprets that experience? So if you take it to the extreme, could you not make an argument about any sort of, I guess my question, Professor Hawkins, is at what point do you say the quality of life is so bad for this person that suicide is warranted? At what point do you say it's not a fight against a person's circumstances? It's not depression. It is, in fact, it's bad. They should be able to off themselves.
Well, at what point is there a point? I think there is. There will be some people for whom that is the right option. But for each person, that will be a very individual, personal decision. There's no simple answer there. It's probably not what you wanted to hear, but I don't quite know how to answer that. I do think that there would be people, I think I said this before, that would be benefited by the law, because I do think that there are people for whom who will suffer unbearably, for whom it is better to end their life. And I do think not all of those people can be helped by palliative care.
Can you describe a case in which that would be the case, a sort of example?
I mean, I think some people are made deeply, you know, miserable, and they're not clinically depressed, but they're deeply upset by the process of losing control of their life, facing their death, seeing their body deteriorate or fall apart. People can suffer because they hate the whole process of seeing their body change so much.
But under which circumstances?
They can have pain too.
Under what circumstances, though? And we have just a few minutes left. Would someone, in your estimation, have reached a point where suicide is really quite reasonable? I mean, can you describe an example of a bedridden, incontinent?
I think it depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the person, right? Some people, being bedridden isn't so bad. Other people, incontinence isn't so bad. It will depend on the person, and it will depend on whether that person has any, you know, in the short amount of time they have left, can it get better? If they're suffering intensely now and they're going to die soon and it's not going to get better in that period of time, then it may well make sense for them. That's all I can say.
Okay, and quickly, Deborah from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
This is for me, Deborah?
Yes, go ahead, quickly.
Oh, sorry, I couldn't hear that. I just wanted to say that I am from Oregon. I live in Wilmington now, and my mother took advantage of Oregon's Death with Dignity in January 2015. I did not see any changes in the law from when it was enacted to the time that she had it, and it's several years. And it was an amazing thing. It's quite the process to get there, but it gave her peace of mind, and she got to have all her family around. So I'm just saying, it needs to be an option.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that experience with us, Deborah. And that is this edition of Coastline. Carol Clay Sutton, Edmund Tyriakian, and Professor Hawkins, thank you all so much for being with us today. And thanks also to Duke University for making Professor Hawkins' appearance possible. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast on iTunes. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. And join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.